Planning for a safe financial future can be tough enough. Doing it successfully in an expensive urban area can be daunting. This week on Techonomics, host Jason Middleton talks with a financial planner and author about how to stay disciplined when you live in an expensive city. That chat begins now.
Hello and welcome back, and thanks for listening. Having talked to financial planners for years, it occurs to me they must feel like they're beating their head against a wall sometimes. The message is steadfast and simple, and often roundly ignored by clients. Save more, save often, diversify. If that's hard enough to get discipline around in general, how about putting those tenets to work in an expensive, almost overpriced urban market, you know, like the Bay Area? This week, an expert analyst, researcher, financial planner, attorney, and author, all the same person, drops by the studio to help us get our heads around living in expensive cities.
I talk to people about budgeting in organizations, and their eyes tend to glaze over.
Mm-hmm.
Budgeting is like dieting. No one wants to do it.
The majority of Americans polled show they would like to see a higher wage floor, minimum wage. And that's only one statistic that leans into our guests' thinking when it comes to budgeting for the Bay Area and beyond. Okay, here we go.
Chuck Collins from the Institute for Policy Studies, co-editor, inequality.org.
Before we went to air, I told you I woke up a little bit late this morning and I was stuck on the bridge. And Howard Schultz, the executive chairman of Starbucks, was being interviewed on CNBC. And it was a live interview. And I was struck by his tone when it comes to inequality. And that's your swing zone. That's your specialty. That's inequality.org is yours. You've done years of research on this stuff. Now, this is a question right off the top. Howard Schultz resigning from Starbucks and being coy about whether he's going to run for president or not, but pinning it on inequality, is that good for your work?
Yes, and actually, I see a lot of business leaders and, you know, in some cases, surprising. I would almost describe their positions as becoming more fluid and surprising, talking about how these extreme inequalities of income, wealth, and opportunity are really raising their alarm bells. They're ringing the alarm just like others have been for a while. So I think it's good for our work to have all kinds of folks saying, look, these extreme inequalities are undermining everything we care about.
You know, you mentioned the high net worth individuals there. The last time you and I spoke, your book was about speaking with other high net worth individuals like yourself about this issue. So how much progress and or not progress have we made since you and I spoke about 14 months ago?
I think the awareness is greater. Even though the country is more polarized in some ways, I think more people recognize that we can't keep going in the direction we're going. We have to intervene and reverse these inequalities. And I've been invited to a lot more sort of high net worth individuals, philanthropic leaders, business leader type gatherings where they're really wrestling with what does it mean and what should they do. I see very rapid progress in engaging on these inequality issues.
Chuck, what does that look like? Because a lot of us are not going to be in the room with an audience of high net worth individuals. Are you having to talk about, like, well, instead of endowing a new chair at your alma mater or a new hospital wing over here, I mean, how do you approach that with people who are looking to be philanthropic, of course, but they might also want to put their name on a beautiful new building and support something that they really, really believe in?
Well, part of the discussion is about both the possibilities and limitations of philanthropy. So there are a lot of people recognizing, oh, well, philanthropy is important. It's kind of a laboratory in some cases for independent sector activities, but it's not a substitute for an adequately funded public sector. Our tax dollars investing in infrastructure and opportunity are actually the things that might really change the outcomes. So for instance, you know, well, maybe we should restore the California inheritance tax that phased out in 2005 and direct it to free higher education for 2.2 million students in the California system. That's the kind of big idea, big game-changing intervention, if you will, that can't be accomplished through philanthropy. And I think the other discussion is, what does it mean to bring wealth home? You know, what does it mean for the wealthy to opt back in to you know, have a stake in the functioning of the society for everyone, not de-link, not take their money and go somewhere else on the planet, but actually bring the wealth home and reestablish a stake. And that's the nature of the conversation I hear, is what does it look like to put the money in the real economy, how to invest in things like, you know, a universal basic income, something you've talked a lot about, Jason, and other things that could reverse these inequalities.
Okay. I know we're talking about high net worth individuals, but I'm struck by the dichotomy that comes in a free range market capitalism like the United States. Corporations are incentivized to keep their profits overseas, although that has changed probably with this coming tax break that was passed in December. But we're seeing that the repatriation of those profits and all that capital is really going to stock buybacks and for investors. It's going back to high net worth individuals. Are we hoping for a trickle down because we're not seeing more hiring and higher wages?
No, I mean, I think the tax bill is going to be a great windfall for some of those companies and for their shareholders and for their top managers, but it's really not going to fundamentally improve the or address the underlying pain of 40 years of stagnant wages. So as much as it's advertised that way, I don't think it will. I mean, when I talk about bringing wealth home, that is an important aspect of it. But it's then the question is, where does that capital go?
Mm-hmm.
Is it vested in the real economy of goods and services, or is it just part of the sort of financial casino? And I'm hopeful, though. Certainly you see in the small business community or U.S.-based kind of rooted enterprises a recognition that that tax bill isn't actually helping them at all and that they're on their own, but they're actually sort of figuring out ways to raise the wage floor and become what I would call kind of high road companies, able to pay living wages and try to care for their employees and make investments in their employees that are good for their bottom line. You see a lot more companies trying to do that.
Well, I read your most recent release last night, is Inequality in America Irreversible? I'm an old newspaper editor. I usually don't like question headlines. This was perfect, though. This one really fit because it really addresses the frustration that many of us have on this topic. And like I said, you're in the front of this. This is your swing zone. What's the thrust of this analysis for you?
Well, one important point is we have to get the diagnosis right to get the solution right. So if we think that inequality is a result of individual differences, individual effort, we're going to continue to focus on individual, you know, how do you help a few individuals? If we think it's simply sort of part of technological change, that will lead to other remedies. It's like a doctor misdiagnosing the illness. But if we understand that it's really the result of a power shift and that the rules of the economy have been tipped to benefit asset owners at the expense of wage earners, and that we know something about how to reverse inequality from both U.S. history after World War II, as well as other countries that have considerably less inequality, we know what it takes to create a shared prosperity economy. So that's one part of it. The other part is just to notice that 70-80% of the population really wants to move in this direction. They really want to reverse these inequalities and create an economy that works for everyone. And that's the basis of a new movement, I think. You may not see it at the federal level, but I think we're starting to see it in regions and cities.
How do you frame this solution that you have in this newest piece of analysis as progressive, but that word not being so loaded, rather than like, let's return to the New Deal kind of thing? Like, is it framed that way? Do you get pushback because I don't want to go back to those 70% income taxes that we had during the New Deal and those kind of things? Are you able to get past that? Because I guess it comes back to politics in a lot of ways, because we're talking policy and that's politics.
Yeah. What I argue, and I think I hear this echoing with business leaders, is, you know, these extreme inequalities of wealth, income, and opportunity are bad for healthy capitalism, bad for the best aspects of our private market economy. It creates volatility, booms and busts, speculative binging.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually going to kill the goose that laid the golden egg. People always say, oh, well, if you tax the wealthy, that will kill the goose that lays the golden egg. But in fact, if we don't address these inequalities, we're going to fundamentally undermine the health of the economy. So that hopefully gets us past the old framework, if you will. It is true that we should restore some progressivity in the tax code. That is a necessary component of this. We have this dizzying concentration of wealth and power at the top, mm-hmm. and there are very few ways to address that other than restoring progressive taxation. But we should be really smart about how we tax and invest in things that create real opportunity and expand, you know, the shared prosperity economy. So I think we're looking for, I call it game-changing campaigns, things that really make a difference in people's lives, whether it's a universal basic income or investing in green infrastructure or eliminating the scourge of college debt, and pay for those by restoring aspects of the progressive, what once was a more progressive tax system.
You're talking just in your answer and in your analysis from Is Inequality in America Irreversible? The rules of governance, right? Game-changing campaigns. You also, in your analysis, spend a little bit of time talking about, well, you just mentioned it there, the scourge of college debt, other things that some other capitalistic systems have already addressed. So this is not like an irrevocable situation. This is something that has been addressed in other places, and we can learn from those models, or we can improve upon those models. Am I overstating that?
Yeah, no, I think, for instance, we can look at to the north, to Canada, or at some of the Nordic countries, and people sort of have the stereotype, well, those are welfare states. But in fact, they are pro-work states. They are investing in people so that they can have meaningful work and, you know, good-paying jobs and can be taxpayers and pay for the public goods that make those better societies to live in now. So, you know, Canada, the American dream, moved to Canada. They have three times the social mobility than the United States now because they're investing in early childhood education. They don't have students graduating with an average of $40,000 in student debt. They have commitments to public goods and public infrastructure. So they're healthier societies. They're also less stressful. I mean, mm-hmm. in the United States, you know, you can fall all the way to destitution, divorce, illness, job loss, and people know that. And even wealthy people know that they can fall all the way. And so having a decent floor of health care and job training and job retraining all contribute to less stress, less polarization, and just a healthier society overall. So we should humbly try to learn something from countries that have considerably less inequality than we do, but have vibrant free market economies.
Data-based decision-making is something that I'm fond of, and you don't have to be a hardcore Keynesian to know that a fatter middle class is better for everybody involved. I mean, the data is just, it's just there. You have some fringe economists on the far edges of the spectrum, but for the most part, the data really does support the fact that a work-friendly economy is a building economy. It's for everyone. Do you find that data helps you whenever you're trying to portray your message?
You know, I do. I mean, I think with a certain segment of people, you can make a pretty compelling case. And you can even look at the experience of the United States, you know, 1945 to 1975, and show how investing in middle class opportunity had a positive stimulative effect on the whole economy. But I'm also struck by how powerful stories about the origins of wealth and, you know, who gets it and who doesn't. We still have these powerful narratives in our mind that kind of hold us back as well. And in some ways, the book I did, Born on Third Base, was more of an attempt to sort of challenge or disrupt the narratives that hold inequality in place. But I think both data and understanding that we live by stories, and that story that, oh, people are where they deserve to be because of their effort, that's the story that holds us back.
I listened intently to a conservative pundit last week, and he fears a snapback to this administration, specifically this administration that we have now, giving the more liberal wing of Democrats control of everything in 2020, leading to a New Deal kind of climate. Is that something that is a headwind or a tailwind, or is it not even an effect for where you stand?
You know, what I look at is the undercurrents. So I do think that the pendulum will swing, and it may swing dramatically. But if you look at just sort of public opinion and demographically, like Where are younger people at? Where are millennials at? Where are, what kind of society do they want to live in? What do they think the role of government should be? We are seeing a realignment at the base. It's hard to see it at the top sometimes, but it's certainly at the base. I mean, 80% of the population, 75%, you know, raises, we should have a much higher wage floor. The wealthy should pay a higher percentage of their taxes. The unpopularity of this recent tax cut is a really interesting sign. I mean, tax cuts poll wildly high. You want a tax cut? Yes. People understood that this recent tax cut was rigged to global corporations that don't have much commitment to this country and the wealthiest 1%, if not the 0.1%. People didn't fall for it. And I think that is a reflection of this realignment that's happening. So if I was a Republican pundit, I would not just be saying, oh, it's about Donald Trump. I would be looking at, what are young people thinking right now? And, you know, there's a reason why Bernie Sanders, you know, is the most popular politician in America right now. He's been saying the same thing for as long as I can remember.
Right, at least 40 years.
It's having a new resonance. It's having a different resonance. And part of that's demographic. And part of that's just people saying, yeah, you know what? Extreme inequality. I don't want to live in an apartheid society. We can do much better.
Is inequality in America irreversible? I think you answered that in several ways. But one way that really impressed me was you answered it by looking forward, not talking about how we got here. You're about a solution in this. It was, are you focusing, if not winnowing, your approach to this in something that's almost like a punch list, like an action item?
I think it is a complicated problem with a lot of different solutions, but I do think that there are some game-changing pressure points, if you will, that could really move us faster. So, for instance, I mentioned, why wouldn't we just go back to the 1960s and 70s in terms of free public higher education? Why wouldn't we go back to 1% 40-year fixed-rate mortgages for first-time homebuyers who've been excluded in this marketplace? Those were the things that we did after World War II that launched the next generation. Well, those are wildly popular ideas. There are people in living memory who can say, yeah, I went to Berkeley, UC Berkeley, and I graduated with savings, and I went off and did my work and can testify to the power of those investments. And I think they're wildly popular, and I think that that's the basis of then, you know, the next social movement. So I think we're in the next couple of years, Jason, we're going to see younger people really stepping up, pushing for college for all. I think we're going to see, obviously, the minimum wage movement has broad support. I think things like taxing high-end real estate. This is something San Francisco's done, but in cities now, we're seeing this huge disruption from all this wealth flowing in from all over the world that's kind of supercharging the existing gentrification problems in our communities. And kaboom, well, what do you do about that? Well, this is global wealth touching down in real property. We should tax it and take that revenue and invest it in things that create opportunity for people. And so I think those are some of the campaigns that I think will be part of how we build more of a national movement that will finally turn the corner on these accelerating inequalities, slow them down and reverse them.
There is so much good information at inequality.org. This is Chuck Collins. He's the author of Born on Third Base. Also, his new one is Inequality in America, Irreversible. Chuck, thanks you so much for the work you've been doing. And honestly, it's really accessible stuff. And I think that the time has come, and I bet you're going to see a spike in traffic on inequality.org.
Thanks, Jason, for this conversation and for just continuing to kind of focus on it and engage people around it. It's important.
That was Chuck Collins. He's the author of a new book titled Is Inequality in America Irreversible? It's a skinny version of his research and analysis that spawns from his work at inequality.org. Mr. Collins was born into wealth and has dedicated his working life to addressing the inequalities and ill societal constructs that come with income inequality. Coming up after the break, we talk about how to live better in expensive cities. Our analyst and guest calls them expense cities.
I talk to people about budgeting and organizations, and their eyes tend to glaze over.
Mm-hmm.
Budgeting is like dieting. No one wants to do it.
That's next, so stick around, please. I'm Jason Middleton, and this is Techonomics.